I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. We've been Disney fans our entire lives. And now, as childless adults, we're undertaking a journey through the media that shaped our lives.
Trying to find out if what made them special is still there.
We are Rewatching the Magic.
Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday.
We're still in the 80s. We were talking about Roger Rabbit last week, and how that was kind of the precursor to the Disney Renaissance. And you could argue that actually influenced some of the popularity of the movie we're talking about this week. Because just a few months later was the release of the movie Oliver and Company, which we're talking about this week. We actually are not alone in discussing this week's movie.
We are not. Would our mystery guest enter and sign in, please?
Ahoy, it's Cornflake from the Flopcast.
Yes, our good friend Cornflake, who we've known for many, many years, co-host of the Flopcast, and 80s aficionado.
Yeah, and if you're going to have a conversation about cartoon dogs, just try and keep me away.
Yeah, so there are a lot of dogs in this movie. This entire movie, we kind of talked about this before in our Waking Sleeping Beauty review, where there was this point right after Eisner and Katzenberg joined, where they just sat the entire animation team, and even some people who weren't a part of the animation team, in their office and pretty much said, "What kind of movie do you want to make?" And there were a lot of suggestions. A sequel to The Rescuers. Treasure Island in space. Let's do a movie based off Pocahontas. And Oliver Twist with dogs. I just like how that was the pitch. Just Oliver Twist? Like, dogs.
And so it came to be.
And hey. Again, Great Mouse Detective was already in production at the time when they were doing this meeting, and Black Cauldron did not do so well. So that was their way of saying, well, let's see what
that's keep... the kindest words anybody's ever said about Black Cauldron.
It pretty much was, what kind of movies do these new young animators, this young blood of animators, because the old men were gone pretty much by this point. What do these young guys want to do? What kind of movies do they want to make? And this was one of them. And apparently from my research, Katzenberg was really on this idea. Apparently he's been wanting to do, at least up until this point, a version of Oliver Twist. Apparently even trying to get the rights to the musical Oliver to try and do that as a modernized film version, which I did not know until researching for this movie.
So, y'all want to know a dirty little secret?
Yes, please.
Today, which is when I finally had time to do the rewatch, is the first time I've ever seen more than 20 seconds of this movie.
Whoa.
This entire movie in my childhood was a quick ad on another Disney VHS I had. I don't remember which one. And all it was like, the, why should I worry? Why should I care? Oliver and Company, buy it on VHS now. My entire knowledge of this movie up until today.
You know,
except for knowing that it was Oliver Twist with dogs starring Billy Joel, which shockingly, was not a thing that I ever wanted to see.
You're the one who, on this very podcast, said that you watched, like, every animated Disney movie in theaters.
Yeah, I did, but this was 1988, and guess who was not allowed to go to movie theaters in 1988, as we have previously discussed?
Yes.
Aww.
It was not until the release of Home Alone that I got to see a movie in a drive-in, and then it wasn't until Beauty and the Beast that I was able to see one in a theater proper. So I missed some of the kind of, you know, earlier stuff around this time. But then after that, once theaters were a thing that were allowed, that's when I started going. So post Beauty and the Beast is when that really started.
Right. So yeah, go ahead.
As the oldest of, well, what was three kids at the time, but ultimately as the oldest of seven children, it was very rare that we got out to the theaters because nobody was going to tolerate a squalling baby in the theaters. But as some folks know, I have had a long-time obsession with Billy Joel. When I was little, I thought I was going to marry him someday. So when there was a dog being voiced by Billy Joel, there was no keeping me away from that theater. So I remember being very excited to go see this one.
Yeah, I actually did get to... I was a Billy Joel fan later. So like maybe mid-90s, my dad got a Billy Joel album and I became a Billy Joel fan because secular pop music was not a thing I was allowed to partake in the 80s either. But I eventually became a Billy Joel fan, and just recently I got the great honor of taking a friend of mine who is one of the biggest Billy Joel fans ever. I mean, you and her should have a fist fight over it, Cornflake. But Billy Joel came to Atlanta, which is a quite a long drive from where I live. It's 4 hours one way, and we did it all in one night. We did not stay overnight. So I drove 4 hours to Atlanta. We watched Billy Joel in concert at the Atlanta Braves Stadium. And then at about midnight, we started the drive back home and made it just before dawn. So that was my going to see Billy Joel story. But he puts on a great concert even today. So
yeah, and this actually is a good... this actually starts something that would influence Disney in the long run, as this is the first movie where Howard Ashman worked on a Disney movie. Howard Ashman, of course, wrote all the songs for Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast. He wrote a bunch of songs for Aladdin before his unfortunate passing. But yeah, he wrote the title song for this movie, Once Upon a Time in New York City.
Beautifully crooned by Huey Lewis, another big favorite of mine. He'd be next in line if Billy Joel turned me down.
If you can't tell, this was an 80s movie, Billy Joel and Huey Lewis.
And Ruth Pointer, for that matter.
Yeah.
I was shocked when I saw Howard Ashman's name as the lyricist for that song.
It was nominated for a Golden Globe, so I think that was enough for Disney to say, let's lock this guy down.
It was nominated for a Golden Globe.
Did you catch in the beginning of the song, if you listen really closely, it almost sounds a bit like In a New York Minute by Don Henley.
Huh. I did not catch that.
So yeah, Oliver and Company, 1988. Again, you have to at least consider that Roger Rabbit's popularity kind of trickled down into this movie, because it was the next full-length animated Disney movie to come out after that movie. Hmm. And this one made some money. This one was actually one of the few successful box office movies of this post-Walt Dark Age era.
Yeah, but we gotta mention why it didn't make even more of the money.
Oh, yeah.
Because this had a very unfortunate opening weekend.
They opened this against The Land Before Time.
Don Bluth.
Here's the thing, though, and this is one of the main things that I wanted to mention about this film. When it started, my father actually was taking a break from work and watched the first part of this with me. Neither of us had ever seen it. The movie started, and my father went, "This is not Disney animation." And I said, "No, this isn't. This looks straight out of a Don Bluth movie." And he went, "Oh my God, you're right." Yeah, this did not feel like a Disney movie to me, animation-wise. If you showed me any random frame of this, I would have pegged it as a Don Bluth film.
And considering that, I think, American Tail kind of kicked Disney's butt the year previous with Great Mouse Detective. Even with, tearing down Black Cauldron. And then following year with All Dogs Go to Heaven. That would be the kind of end of it, because Don Bluth was kind of kicking Disney's butt at this point.
Very true. It does look quite different.
So why not imitate the style? Mm.
Yeah, I could see that. The other major thing is that we talked a little bit about this on Brave Little Toaster. This was right in that sweet spot when Disney wanted that brand marketing money.
Oh yeah, the amount of product placement in this movie. And they said it's for realism because it's supposed to be modern day New York. But even films that have attempted to do modern day New York kind of don't always put, even in the 80s, didn't always put real brands in there.
Yeah, but I mean, this is possibly the most egregious one that Disney ever did, because there are like something like 24 or more.
Mm-hmm.
Brands, I think I read in this, so
probably why it's also made money.
Yes,
yeah, maybe most of the gross came from just product placement.
And this actually started the for a little more trivia. This actually started the relationship with McDonald's. That for a long time, you know, Disney and you can go to McDonald's and get the toy from the latest Disney movie.
This is where it all began.
Yeah, the first Disney toys at McDonald's were little stuffed animal Christmas ornaments of Oliver and Dodger.
Yeah, I do remember that.
So, Oliver Twist with dogs. Consider yourself at home.
We mentioned last week Dominic Noble's Lost in adaptation, and I kind of would love to see him lose his mind trying to do this one, because it would be like he does it in various shifts of like what they kept the same and what they changed. And I think what they kept the same would be like some of the names, what they changed, everything else.
Oliver, Dodger, Fagin, Sykes. That's about it.
Yep, and pretty much it's like, and they're criminals of a sort, but they're not really criminals because they're dogs, so it doesn't carry any sort of weight to it.
Yeah,
you know, yeah.
I kind of liked that about this, though. I think it'd be a little more difficult to digest as a children's movie if they were full on criminals, the dogs.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's just impossible to do it in that way unless you bring in like the idea of like a dog catcher and some sort of justice system but as far as humans go, if a dog runs up to you and takes something and runs away, you might be annoyed by it, but you're not going to be like, well, how did his parents raise him, teaching him the criminal way? Like, it's just, it's a dog.
Well, man, I would be like, I can't be mad, that was actually clever.
Yeah, I've had dogs do that to me before. I had a dog run a con on me to get my chicken wing bones one time, and at the end I'm like, I'm not even mad at it. I'm only taking this away from you because you could slice your throat up and I don't want you to do that. And then I gave it like cheese or something. It's like, I'm sorry you can't have the chicken bones. Please have this cheese in compensation.
I mean, talking about things that changed, too, in comparison to the Charles Dickens novel, I also think I was vaguely aware of the fact that there was such a thing as an Oliver musical back then, musical based on the book. And yep. It's kind of neat to see that the movie had music, but I'm surprised it didn't derive anything from the musical that already existed.
Probably ironically, it derived something. Well, yeah, that too. But ironically, it derives something from My Fair Lady, but not from Oliver.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. Honestly, I kind of think I would have been more interested in this movie when before today, had it been Oliver the Musical with dogs. Because I loved Oliver the Musical as a kid. I watched that one all the time. That was a perennial classic
again,
in our house.
Billy Joel singing Consider Yourself.
Whoa.
he could probably rock that.
Yes.
I'm fine with it.
Speaking of, let's actually talk about who's actually in this movie besides Billy Joel. And that would be a pre-heartthrob Jory Lawrence. as Oliver.
Well, yeah, this was a very interesting spot in Joey Lawrence's career, because I was like, well, where exactly was he in his career? He had just come off of Give Me a Break, which was his first big, you know, big role.
I apologize. My dog Callie wanted to check in to say that she was a fan.
Oh, we love dogs on this show. You may hear Bowie later if somebody in a loud car drives by the house. But yeah, Give Me a Break had just ended. And then Joey Lawrence got Oliver and Company. And then about 2 years later, he would get cast on Blossom. And so while some people would have known Joey Lawrence's name from Give Me a Break, specifically kind of parents, I think, at the time, he wouldn't become like heartthrob Joey Lawrence until about 2 years after this.
Yeah.
Blossom was not a bad place to land after Oliver and Company.
No. Again, he had grown and his voice had changed at that point. Again, teen heartthrob at that point.
And yeah. Getting,
and try to start that music career.
To, let's say, mixed success.
There's a reason Oliver doesn't sing in this movie.
Strangely, there is another 90s teen heartthrob in this movie, but uncredited and not any named character. One of the background voices in this was a very young, probably about the same age as Joey Lawrence, honestly, Jonathan Brandis.
Wow.
That he provided some of the kind of background voices of little kids and stuff.
Aww.
So, yeah. And then he would go on later to be another massive teen idol around the same time as Joey Lawrence was. I cared nothing for Joey Lawrence. I cared greatly for Jonathan Brandis because he was on my favorite television show.
So yeah, of course, Billy Joel as Dodger, and the fact that they actually had Dodger at one point play the piano and wear the sunglasses because they had to.
Right.
How else would you know it was Billy Joel?
That's true.
Ironically, I did watch a behind the scenes. There is a little behind the scenes thing on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
And I watched that as well. And weirdly, Billy Joel looks more like Bruce Springsteen in the behind the scenes footage. Like when he came in to record, he's wearing basically Bruce Springsteen's stage getup.
Wow.
Instead of wearing his own kind of feel.
With the sunglasses. Apparently he recorded all of this with sunglasses on.
No sunglasses. Not a sunglass in sight. Thank you very much.
I actually owned this movie on Blu-ray, and I saw some of the behind-the-scenes stuff on there. And yeah, there's actually some clips of him doing some voiceover work, probably staged just for some behind-the-scenes stuff of him with the sunglasses doing some of the lines.
Oh, that is precious.
So yeah, Billy Joel. Cheech Marin as Tito, the Chihuahua. Again, he will go on to do a lot more Disney work, of course, with The Lion King.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Again, he was really popular at this point in his career in the 80s. So, you know, why not bring him into you know, try to get some of that fame rub off with Disney?
It was his character in this movie that made me want a Chihuahua at that point in life. That character just pops so much.
It's Cheech Marin playing Cheech Marin, which is usually what he does in these movies.
So
yeah,
well.
I don't think I've ever seen Cheech Marin play not Cheech Marin. It's like, what the one character?
Yeah, like whether it, even in Lion King, even in the freaking Spy Kids movies.
But you know, when we talked about Tommy Chong in Zootopia, he's just playing Tommy Chong as like a llama.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't think either of them have ever played a second character in their entire life.
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, Tito is not even, he goes into the trademark Hispanic 12 name long name thing.
Yeah.
Ignacio Alonso Julio Federico de Tito. And yes, I had to read that. I could not remember that.
That's okay. Nobody faults you.
So let's see who we got here. Richard Mulligan as Einstein, the Great Dane. He's kind of the elder statesman of the team, but he's also the dim-witted one.
It was such an odd contrast to his character on Empty Nest, which I remember watching as a kid, too.
Yeah, he was such a big sitcom actor. I mean, that was like primarily his thing, you know, Empty Nest and Soap and, you know, that's just kind of where everybody knew him from.
And it's kind of what they were doing with Disney at this time, even with, you know, Bob Newhart and the Rescuers. You know, they were taking these well-known sitcom stars and putting them in their movies, at least someone that the adults would know. And even we talked about this with Bug's Life, you know.
Yeah, someone Bug's Life was all sitcom stars.
Yeah, someone that the adults would at least know who they were, or at least recognize the voices.
Yeah.
In contrast to the roles that I saw Richard Mulligan take on in television, I can only imagine him having the best time voicing this Grey Dane with all of the goofiness of it.
Go find Bumper. Roscoe Lee Brown as Francis. Not Frank. Not Frankie. Francis. The uptight British bulldog who is a very connoisseur of theater. He's watching Shakespeare at one point. At another point, he's watching ballet. So he's kind of...
He's a cultured pup.
He's a cultured... Even though he is part of this gang that steals things.
Yeah. People who are our age will probably recognize his voice best as the narrator in Babe. The Babe movies.
Yeah.
But he was on a lot of 80s cartoons as well. He was Kingpin in the 90s Spider-Man. He shows up again in Wild Thornberries. We're going to talk about him again whenever we get to Treasure Planet.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he had a pretty good... And then, of course, he's just kind of a very famous just kind of character actor throughout the 70s to the 90s, really, was kind of his heyday. I kind of knew him best for doing the voice of Box in Logan's Run, the murderous little robot that's in there.
Yeah. Let's move on. We talked about Ruth Pointer, but Cheryl Lee Ralph did the talking voice for Rita, and Ruth did the singing voice.
Right.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that I don't really know why Cheryl Lee Ralph just didn't do her own singing, because she won a Tony for Dreamgirls, so why would you not... I guess they just wanted to keep the, like, really famous singers, but, you know, she could have sung her own thing.
She probably could have. I think that they probably wanted Ruth to do the whole thing and realized she wasn't that good of an actor.
Possibly.
But they still needed that pointer power.
Yeah.
I think out of all of the dogs, character-wise, she may be my favorite. Maybe because she has the most empathy.
She, you know, we're supposed to think Dodger is kind of the leader, but Rita kind of acts more like the leader of the dogs than Dodger does.
Well, she's very much cast in the mom role.
And when you're the only girl in a group like that, that's kind of your default. You're like the mom.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah, that is the girl character in like every 80s cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
Very true.
So,
and she's, you know, she's actually looking out after Oliver, you know, during her song as Oliver's trying to cross the street, she's kind of holding him back. Hey, watch where you're going.
Right.
And she's the only one that kind of actually wants to listen to Oliver after they kidnapped him.
Right, she's the one who said we should have never taken him.
Yeah. So it's like, and for as little character development that Rita gets, she is a pretty good character in this movie. For, you know, and And I'm surprised that they did not even tease any kind of romance between her and Dodger.
Oh, that is interesting.
They could have for this movie, especially with Dodger kind of being a kind of a playboy with the other female dogs in the movie, especially during his song.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they do get to sing "Why Should I Worry" at the end of the movie, but that's the only time it's ever anything is ever implied between the two. But it's like for the most of the movie, it's like they're just teammates. You want to talk about Don Bluth? Dom DeLuise is Fagin.
Yes. Oh, it was perfect.
Because when I don't think Disney, when I think Dom DeLuise, I think Don Bluth. Because, you know, All Dogs Go to Heaven and American Tail. That's Dom DeLuise for me.
Good point.
Yeah.
But as Fagin in this movie, like when he's trying to write that ransom note and the ironing board keeps getting lower and lower as he's trying to write on it, he's making those signature Dom DeLuise noises, and it just makes me giddy to hear it.
Yeah. Again, it's really one Dom DeLuise playing Dom DeLuise.
Mm, good point. Very much.
I mean, Disney knows who they're getting. Like, we're getting Dom DeLuise. We're going to write him like a Dom DeLuise character.
Very true here.
Yeah, and even, you know, him, the way he acts scared from Sykes and all, you know, it was an accident. Like, that's just pure Dom DeLuise. speaking of Sykes, Robert Loggia, is that how you pronounce his name?
It's R, as in Robert Loggia.
Loggia, thank you.
O, as in, oh my god, that's Robert Loggia. Sorry. all you Family Guys fans out there just had a moment.
Yeah,
but yeah, Sykes. Robert Loggia, yeah, the great Robert Loggia.
Yes, we're not sure if he, I mean, we know he's a loan shark. We don't know. He might not need any kind of backup because he's like pretty beefy himself. He's one of the few mob bosses that's his own hitman.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, and also he has dogs.
Yeah, yeah. He has a dog.
And presumably a driver. Although we never see the driver, he's just always in the back seat of the car and the car somehow drives itself.
Well, he was in the driver's seat when we first meet him. He's in the driver's seat.
I thought that was the back.
He is in the driver's seat. And
Well, apparently he doesn't even have a driver. There we go.
He's a one-man show. And hey. He's scary. Think about this. A mob boss in a Disney movie.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we don't even really know he's a mob boss. We don't ever see a mob.
No, he's just himself. He's just... Again, he's a loan shark that's his own muscle.
Who apparently also owns some sort of warehouse.
Yes, we don't know what it is, but that's...
Yes.
He owns a warehouse, he loans out money to people, and, you know, if you can't get his money back, he takes care of you personally.
So, when he's having that phone call, when he's describing how... What steps you take first before you put them in the cement shoes. That is, you think, just somebody calling him for advice as opposed to one of his associates.
Probably. It's like, hey, you know, Mr. Sykes, you know, you're kind of the expert on this thing. What do we do? Well, first you break his knuckles.
Yes.
So it's like, you know, he's also, you know, a mentor to other wannabe mob bosses. Maybe.
If this goes the way of Brave Little Toaster and we just make this like a way worse movie, I think we scarred some people after Brave Little Toaster.
I enjoyed that episode.
So, yeah, Natalie Gregory as Jenny, the little girl that adopts Oliver. This is actually another bit of trivia. It was not supposed to be Jenny. That was not supposed to be the kid's original name. It was originally supposed to be Penny, as in the little girl from The Rescuers. When we talked about a sequel to The Rescuers, this was originally going to be it. Because at the end of The Rescuers, Penny is adopted by this family, and they still live in New York. This was supposed to be the follow-up, her living with her new rich parents and adopting Oliver.
Wow.
I will say that as far as Jenny is concerned, I appreciate Disney's restraint in having her parents just be neglectful as opposed to dead.
Yeah, they're on the other side of the world.
I guess that's a step up.
They're on the other side of the world at some sort of conference. We don't know what kind of conference. We don't know what their job is, that they're just in Rome. First, they're in Paris, and they're going to be in Rome for a conference, and they're going to miss their kid's birthday.
Yeah, and at least at the end, she gets a phone call saying that they're on their way home.
Which would not have worked with Penny, because again, here's this orphan girl who just wanted to be who wanted parents, and then they just leave her for to go on this business trip.
Yeah, it would have been kind of tragic had it. I mean, it's still tragic, but it would have been like especially tragic had that been the follow up.
Yeah. So let's get to the only other big name actor in terms of singing. The Divine Miss M herself, Bette Midler as Georgette.
Wow, her performance in this movie is pretty captivating.
Bette Midler never does anything half-ass.
Again, not the only time she would work with Disney. She, of course, would do Hocus Pocus about 10 years later.
And again, 20 years later or something, maybe, I think.
Yeah.
There's still... Is that official, or is that...
We don't know yet.
Okay.
Again,
all the actors have said they're down, so...
Everything's on hold because of coronavirus.
Stupid coronavirus.
Little note that I actually found out in doing some research. Apparently, Bette Midler, back when they were originally doing their plans for the Snow Queen movie, before it got changed, Bette Midler was going to play the Snow Queen. Before it became Frozen.
Wow.
I think
can
she
you imagine would've... Bette Midler singing Let It Go?
Yes, I can.
Even her song, she kind of has a little Ethel Merman in it. Maybe it's me.
Well, yeah, because she gets the big comedy song.
Yeah.
So she gets to play with all of her kind of, you know, weird bathhouse kind of goofiness.
I'll tell you what, Jared, I can picture it from a distance.
But let's talk about the last little voice actor here, because this was the one that made me laugh.
Oh, this made me laugh too. I wonder if it's for the same reason.
So we got Frank Welker back again. Frank Welker. And in a movie full of animals, who does Frank Welker play? The one human.
That hates four-legged creatures.
That hates animals, yeah. Frank Welker, a man infamous for playing dogs, plays the human.
The
hot dog vendor.
Yeah, old Louie.
It's hysterical that when you think about it, of all the characters he could voice.
Yeah.
Because we talk about how if there was a cartoon in the 70s or the 80s that has, and by we I mean my co-host and I, Kevin Eldridge of the Flopcast, when we're talking about cartoons from the 70s and 80s, if there is an animal in the cast, it's generally Frank Welker is the voice. And then here you have Oliver and Company, and he voices the hot dog guy.
Yeah, especially since, you know, Frank Welker known for voicing a Great Dane, you got Richard Mulligan voicing a Great Dane.
Yeah. 700 random animal sounds here. Who do we give to Frank? The hot dog guy.
Do you have to question the wisdom there?
I question the wisdom of a lot of things with this movie. I'm just going to be honest.
You would think that they would have him do like some of the animal sounds. Like there's a scene where would have been perfect for a Frank Welker cat screech when Oliver is scared out of his mind.
Oh, yeah, and there's, like, all kinds of animals throughout the movie of all sorts of species. There's birds and rats and, you know, more dogs than even the main cast. And, you know, why would you not just have him fill in the... Nope. Hot dog guy.
Hot dog guy. Let's actually get into the movie proper here. starting with the song Once Upon a Time in New York City, with the Disney Plus version still has the classic Blue Castle logo, which, like we've said before, is likely only there because the score says so. Because they would have to rescore that entire opening just to accommodate the more modern Disney intro.
Yeah. Also, this film, unlike a lot of ones that they've put up on Disney Plus, has not been touched up in the slightest. It is there in all of its 80s glory? Question mark.
This is what you, this is a good example of what they called the Xerox method back in the day. So if you don't know what the Xerox method was, around the time of 101 Dalmatians, they wanted a way to make Disney wanted to make movies faster and cheaper. So they decided to straight Xerox the actual sketches that the animators were doing directly onto the cells. So they wouldn't be transferred from paper to silicone or cellophane. And it did speed up the process, but you get a lot of the rough sketches, a lot of the thick black lines that kind of define that era. Walt hated it because it wasn't as clean as he wanted it to be, because of, you could even see, if you look close enough and stop at certain frames, you could still see some sketch lines. But the animators loved it because it was their artwork on screen.
Yeah. I always wondered about that. I wondered if they had meant to make the style look like that. And it makes a whole lot more sense the way that you describe it.
Yeah, and they would. This would be the last movie they did that for, because they would go back to their traditional method for Little Mermaid.
What a difference between these two movies, huh?
Exactly. What a difference a year makes.
Well, I was going to say, we talk a lot about how well 2D animation holds up over the years, and how beautiful all of the Disney Renaissance films are, and, you know, this one not so much to me on a purely artistic level. I think that process is part of the reason why. If you're watching it on a movie screen in the 80s projected, you know, via 35mm or whatever, you're not going to see it as much, but when you're watching it in 2020 on a 4K TV, you know, it does not look as clean and beautiful as some of the other ones.
Yeah, even some of the back, I mean, it's very clear they also just drew over pictures of New York City for this one, for some of the backgrounds. Like, there's
Flag. This was an early mashup of computers as well. A lot of the backgrounds were computer generated.
Ah, I mean, we've talked about that before, and like Great Mouse Detective had a whole scene with just the whole Big Ben scene was computer animated. We would talk about that with like some of the scenes in Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. But this is one of those, if you didn't tell me, I wouldn't have known, because they didn't really notice it.
Well, to me, I knew that something was off, and it was mentioned in that behind-the-scenes thing I watched, but I kind of knew something was off watching the movie, because it was not even a CGI necessarily the way we would think of it, but it was an early computer process that they did the backgrounds, and then they laid the hand-drawn animation cells on top of it. And as a result, the characters kind of look like they're floating on top of the backgrounds in a lot of scenes. So it's not as, like, cleanly integrated as a lot of them would be later.
Yeah, and what's one of the first images you see when you put this movie on? The Twin Towers.
Oh, yeah. Boy, my heart skipped a beat. I completely forgot that that's how this movie began.
It's the New York skyline, especially in the 80s. This is a pre-9/11 world.
Yeah, I mean, even when you're doing something now, if you have a set piece in New York, you know, 2000 or earlier, you have to put it in there, because there's barely a shot of New York ever that didn't have those in there. They loomed so large in the skyline.
Yeah. with such prominence. Yeah. I had forgotten that that was there, and it surprised me for a split second.
Yeah. It was, they had to do it recently in S.H.I.E.L.D. too. They had to CGI the towers into a 1970s New York in the most recent season. Mm. And it kind of comes out of nowhere. It's like 1970s New York, and then it opens, and there's the Twin Towers really big in the shot of the city. And I'm like, oh yeah, they would have had to add those back in. Oh, it hurts my heart.
Yeah, and now the same thing with the backgrounds. You see, like, the backgrounds, and, you know, the cars are not moving, the flags are not waving, yet here are all these people walking down the street. Which is something that you would not see in a fully, like, even Walt era or even the Renaissance era. They would have those details, you know?
So, can we talk about this opening song? Because I really want to talk about this opening song.
Yeah, Once Upon a Time in New York City, Howard Ashman wrote it, and Huey Lewis sang it. You see the little box, Kittens Need Homes, and you see all these little cute little kittens that are clearly not as well drawn as Oliver is, because they're not really main characters in the story. And each and every one of them gets adopted, and Oliver is the only one that isn't. It's kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah, and it keeps going from, like, you know, cats, $3, cats, $2.50, cats, and then eventually it's like, just take it.
Free.
Yeah, to take the cats.
take the darn cats.
All the while you're hearing Huey Lewis going, Oliver, don't be shy. It's like,
ask you two about that. Do you know of any other Disney movie where somebody who's singing a song about what's going on directly speaks to one of the characters in the movie? Because I can't think of any other Disney movie where that happens.
Yeah, the singer is actually the narrator, if you want to call it that, is actually talking to Oliver. It's like, you know, this is going to eat you up.
He's giving it a pep talk.
Yeah. Yeah, don't be shy, Oliver. Then he's going to go, who's Oliver? I haven't been named yet. I don't get named until an hour into the movie.
But neither of you can think of another Disney movie where this happens, right? Because no. I think that's
not
like
off the top of my head.
Once in a lifetime thing for Disney to have a song in the soundtrack where after singing about the scene, the singer starts singing to one of the characters.
Yep.
But also, I mean, anybody who's listened to more than one episode of this podcast knows how much I absolutely love and worship at the feet of Howard Ashman. Boy, was he, like, half asleep when he wrote this, because this is not that, like, well, I said, I was shocked.
He didn't have Ellen Menken to help him out.
Yeah, but the lyrics were never Menken's thing. Menken doesn't really do lyrics. That's the point of him. It's the actual lyrics. Like, even if you just read the lyrics, I was sitting there watching it, and it's like, go on, Oliver, you keep dreaming that dream. And I'm like, what dream does this cat have other than don't die? Are we calling that a Disney level dream now? Because it's not like, I want to marry a prince, or I want to have all the cat food in the world. It's like, please, something don't crush me.
I don't
right
want to
now.
Live in a box with water in it.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not thinking that that's really like a dream worth a Disney song, you know?
I dreamed to not go down this storm drain.
Which immediately made me go like, come on, Oliver, we all float down here. Like, you just expect to see Tim Curry pop out and be like, would you like a balloon, little kitty?
Oh, my.
I told you, this is going to be Brave Little Toaster all over again. I'm going to make this the movie of your nightmares.
And you kind of, I mean, again, you do feel sad about Oliver as it's raining, and the only home he knows, this cardboard box, just breaks apart.
Because it's a swimming pool.
Yeah.
And then bursts.
And he's, like, desperately trying to hang on to that last piece of cardboard, like, don't leave me, wall! You're the only wall I've ever known. Come back.
And then, you know, he's in the cold. He gets chased by these alley dogs.
It's foreshadowing, right?
Yeah. And he just hides under this Ryder truck. Like, that's the only shelter he has. That's how you open this movie, by this little cat. Dude, just having the entire city literally trying to eat him.
All while Huey Lewis is crooning with the keyboards of the late 80s. Beautiful song.
Please, let's watch this cat have his life destroyed to the lovely strains of Huey Lewis.
This cat lost about three of his lives in the opening number.
Very true.
He's almost crushed by that rider truck, too. Like, it takes him way too long to figure out, maybe I should hop off this tower, this tire, before it crushes me.
Yep. And, again, this is where he meets old Louie at the hot dog stand. First, he meets the little breakdancer guy, I guess, because he's wrestling like an 80s breakdancer with the boombox.
Well, yeah, we have to rap into this. Because that was a new thing.
Yeah, I mean, and then Oliver just grooving to this. If he had kept up, the guy might have taken him in.
Good point.
A breakdancing cat would have been a different movie.
Yeah, you know what I find? If you had been busking in New York with a breakdancing cat, you'd make so much money.
And then years later, not long though thereafter, there was MC Scat Cat. So
yeah,
that's the origin of MC Scat Cat, right there.
So when I saw it was this scene in particular that I was watching that made me wonder, wait, the rest of the animals in this are dogs. Do you think at any point the team that was assembling Oliver and company thought maybe it should be a puppy and not a kitten?
Possible. I mean, the whole point was Oliver's was with dogs, so it's possible it could have been a puppy. But I guess they went with a cat.
Wonder why they changed the dynamic there.
Hmm. I think because in the original story of Oliver, Oliver is kind of the outsider to the group.
Ah.
Like, yes, he's an orphan, but he spent most of his life, instead of on the streets, he was in an orphanage. He's the one that kind of has to learn a completely different way of life. And I'm not saying it wouldn't have worked with a dog, but it does make him kind of stand out a little more as the outsider if you make him a cat. So I can kind of see why they did it.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't do the whole, please, sir, I want some more in this movie. I don't know how that would have worked in this movie, but, you know. That's kind of like the scene.
It would have worked with the hot dog vendor.
Yeah, if he had been a little kinder.
You want more? Well, I mean, the whole point of that scene was that the guy running the orphanage was not a kind person. So I can see it being done there.
Yeah, here's a dog, kid. Leave me alone. Please, sir, I want some more. I don't know. And enter the Artful Dodger. Himself, kind of grooving in there to the instrumental version of Why Should I Worry before we even hear the song proper. And kind of flirting with... When I first watched this movie, I thought that was Lady from Lady and the Tramp, but it's not. Because it's the same shade of brown. It's sort of the same kind of dog breed, almost.
Different face, though.
Yeah. Even having the bow in her hair like Lady does, so it's like... I assume that was... I wouldn't doubt that was at one point meant to be a lady, but they just changed it.
To a poorly drawn lady?
Maybe. And, you know, Dodger there kind of flirting with her, and she's just, like, not having it. Like not worth my time. And he's, like, flirting off, like, yeah, la-di-da.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, you weren't that hot anyway. Right. Typical, you know, guy getting rejected. Yeah, you weren't that cute anyway. And he kind of, seeing Oliver kind of messing around with Louie, and he starts to plan of the two of them getting the hot dogs. And, Dodger's plan is, well, play the type and start chasing the cat and getting the hot dogs. It's a pretty smart move, you know. Wish he had actually told Oliver about the plan, but it probably wouldn't have worked as well.
Here's the crazy thing. Dodger ultimately gets the hot dogs and continues to sing his Why Should I Worry, Why Should I Care song with a rope of hot dogs fashioned around his neck like a necklace. And it brings out all the other dogs in town, but not to eat the hot dogs, as dogs would be wont to do. They come out and they perform a flash mob with him in the street. How are those other dogs not immediately running at him and trying to eat his hot dog necklace?
And how good are those hot dogs after he walks in wet cement with them?
Do you think a dog would care? Especially true. Street dogs.
Cement-flavored hot dogs, all in a day's work for them.
You know, you just kind of see him wandering around the New York with the dragging the hot dogs in all this dirt stuff, and all you keep hearing is Homer Simpson going, "It's just a little cement. It's so good. It's so good."
Good. And of course, you know, them drying off the wet cement and going using the subway grate to dry off poor Oliver once it's blown away, and he gets
such a fuzzball.
He becomes a fuzzball. And then they crash into the sunglass truck, and then, of course, you get Dodger wearing his sunglasses, because he's Billy Joel. How would you know he's Billy Joel if he doesn't wear the sunglasses?
And playing the piano with his
tail. Playing the piano, yeah. It's like, that had to be intentional. That's just not...
Oh, for sure it was, because Billy Joel took this role around the time that he had a young daughter, Alexa, who was going to appreciate the fact that her daddy was in a movie.
A movie that she could watch. Though her daddy plays
exactly.
And you know, even as we were saying before, you know, all the other dogs in the town start following Dodger. Even some of the girls start rearing up their behinds to him. at least he didn't go and sniff them, because this is still a Disney movie.
I suppose Dodger's not too cool that he doesn't sniff butts now and again.
There's a couple of kind of getting it past the censors in this one. There's a beautiful one later with Bette Midler, but
oh, we'll get to that. And yeah, and say what you will, Oliver keeps up with Dodger the entire time. For just a day old or a couple of days old cat, probably not even a week old, is able to keep up with this. Would keep up with Dodger the entire time, climbing as he's climbing and jumping as he's jumping, just to keep up with him. Kudos to Oliver.
Very much.
Or Kid, as he's called at this point, because he doesn't have a name yet.
Yeah. I want to get into like a general comment about the music a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So they got Huey Lewis for the first song,
mm-hmm.
and they got Billy Joel for the second song.
Mm-hmm.
Two men who are well known for being really good songwriters wrote some of the biggest hits of the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't you let them write any part of their music? Like, every song in here is written by a completely different team of people. And only one of them kind of feels like... I only liked one of them. Of all the songs in here, I only liked one of them. Because they got a songwriter I respected, and that songwriter was kind of actually brought it. I really do feel like I love Howard Ashman, but I really do feel like he slept walk through the like they called him the day before and was like, write some kind of Disney song about New York. Okay.
So, you know, Ashman could probably write an entire musical in his sleep.
Yeah, and honestly, Billy Joel could too. I mean, Billy Joel is a prolific songwriter.
I mean, right. They did Moving Out with Billy Joel's song, so.
Well, yeah, but I mean, for this one, why do you get Billy Joel and not just have him be like, you know, hey, can you look over this song? Is it something that you feel is kind of in your style? Or do you have any suggestions for punching it up? I mean, Billy Joel has written some amazing story songs.
true. I found it odd that he did not get to write any songs for this movie.
Yeah, and same thing for Huey Lewis. Huey Lewis, I think Huey Lewis could have knocked that out of the park if you'd actually let him write at least part of it.
Oh, a song about a city?
Yeah! Huey Lewis writing a song about New York in the 80s? Yes!
Yeah, okay, let's kind of move on to meet the rest of the gang at their little hideout and kind of get the gist of every character in that little moment. You get, you know, Francis kind of being pompous and watching Shakespeare. Tito's kind of being generic Mexican guy.
He's dancing.
He's dancing to Spanish music and singing in Spanish lyrics. And, you know, you get Einstein, which is the joke that he's dim-witted and his name is Einstein. And Rita's the girl. And apparently it was Francis's turn to get food for them, and he failed because he was watching Shakespeare on TV.
Good thing that Dodger stole those francs from Oliver.
Exactly. So Dodger saves the day, and I love how he goes into the story and how this ferocious cat fought him over the hot dogs.
As if it's not a day old or several day old kitten.
Yeah, and, you know, on cue, here comes Oliver just falling through, and they're kind of joking about, oh, this is the ferocious cat you've talked about. Oh, I do like that, those burning eyes of his. It's almost like Rita's trying to make Dodger jealous, but even though she knows it's not working.
No, I was just going to say, I do like the part in the scene where Tito suggests they eat the cat.
The cat is no bigger than you, Tito.
Yeah.
It's a good point. In my mind, there is nothing better for an entrance in a cartoon, be it a cartoon TV show or a cartoon movie, than a character falling in from the ceiling.
Yeah.
And into some kind of cloth.
Yeah.
Right. And people going like, what is that? Is that a ghost? Is it an alien?
It's an alien!
Yeah. It's just such an old cartoon joke.
And it works for this one, especially, you know, like, and then you get the look of Dodger. He kind of smiles like, hey, he really did follow me all the way here.
Like, so impressed.
Yeah, Dodger's impressed. And he would say, hey, well, what took you so long, kid? And Dodger, from this point on, he kind of has a soft spot for Oliver, even letting him snuggle up with him when they're sleeping. Like, he could pull the tough guy routine and not having him, you know, kind of push him away, but he kind of welcomes the kid in.
Yeah.
He doesn't get angry with him. He doesn't say, you know, what are you doing here? How did you get here? That's everybody else. But Dodger's like, huh. All right, kid. You got some of my respect. I'm not going to let you do a low five on me, but you got my respect. And of course we meet, you know, Fagin, who is apparently in debt to Sykes. We don't know why. We don't know what for. All we know is that he lives in this rundown little area on the docks. We don't know how or why he got there. But these dogs, and he owes a lot of money to Sykes. And Sykes is giving him 3 days. Three sunrises, three sunsets, 3 days.
Which he tries to make out to be 9. I think.
Kudos to, I mean, on one hand, Fagin is kind of that dumb, but on the other hand, he's trying to extend the deadline. And, you know, again, we kind of get a nice little family moment, little family moment with Fagin and the dog. He's reading them a bedtime story of the little dog and his rabbit pal Bumper.
Do you do this with your dog at all, Kiki?
What, read stories?
Read bedtime stories or tell your dog a bedtime story.
Not really. The thing I do most with my dog is sing musicals at it. And, like, musicals I make up on the spot about what we're doing. You know?
I totally read Callie bedtime stories, and I'm not ashamed to admit it. Who knows if she's really listening?
Well, that's I gotta say, that is one of the most awesome things that we do now for little kids, is that when little kids are learning to read, a lot of libraries now have a Reading to Rover program.
Yeah.
Where kids can go read books to dogs, and it'll just be like a therapy dog or somebody's dog that they bring in that's like really chill and will just sit there. And all because it helps kids develop their confidence for reading out loud, because the dog is not going to go like, no, sweetie, that's not how you pronounce that. You're reading a little slow. You need to read a little fast. Like, the dog will just sit there and stare.
Very
and
true.
So the kid can do it in their own time and work through their own mistakes. So it's been a very successful program around the country.
I should mention I also read to my kid who appreciates my nighttime story reading.
Go away, kid. This is dog story time.
It's dog's turn.
Yeah, we were talking about it before the show, but you are our first parent on this show.
Oh, wow. Who saw that coming? Yes, I have my dog Callie and my kiddo Cal, who by the way has not seen Oliver and Company yet. I feel there are parts of it that might frighten him a bit. It's interesting to think that the darker scenes of the movie back in the late 80s were things that the censors certainly weren't afraid to let the kids see, and it wasn't something parents thought about back in the day. But some of those very threatening scenes gave me nightmares for a couple of days afterwards. And so I'm probably going to wait a couple of years before my kiddo sees this one.
Again, this was a few years after The Black Cauldron. Look at the nightmare fuel that movie is.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think that that's like a generational thing? Because if you look back at like the movies that our parents grew up with, like their generation's kids' movies, and you look at them now and you're like, who would show this to a child?
That was dark.
And so it was like toned down a lot in the 80s and 90s, comparatively. Yeah. And then now you look back at stuff in the 80s and 90s, you're like, they'd never get away with that now. Who thought that was okay to show us as kids? What kind of monsters raised us? You know?
It is a different feel to watch a character, for example, in Oliver and Company, get blown away by a train. It's a different feel than watching Wile E. Coyote. Sorry, I can't talk today, apparently. it's a different feel than watching Wile E. Coyote take a train in the face, to actually see it happen to a character that looks like a human.
Yeah.
And also because immediately after Wile E. Coyote gets the train to the face, he stands back up and shakes it off and keeps on walking.
Yeah.
Which is not exactly what happens to Sykes.
No. So, yeah, it's kind of, So let's kind of go to the next day where they're trying to figure out a way to make money so Fagin can stay alive for another day, because he only has 3 days left to live, apparently.
Mm-hmm. And apparently their solution is
steal a car.
Steal a radio from a car. Like, no, they're going for the radio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't even like steal a car or steal, you know, a jewelry or whatever. Like, no, let's go jack a car radio.
It is the 80s. Car radio stealing was a thing, especially in New York.
But it's just like, once again, not a thing you would think of dogs doing.
Well, you would think not of just like, any dogs.
You know, you would think Fagin would hold up like a bracelet or something and be like, see how shiny this is? Go find me that.
We don't know how long they've been doing this. We don't know exactly how long they've been this level. So maybe he's trained them to steal car radios.
He's training them to get electrocuted.
I mean, if Fagin can teach a group of dogs to steal car radios with success, I mean, we wonder if they've ever had success at it, because, you know, he's not exactly swimming in the money. But then Fagin would have been the greatest dog trainer of all time and could have had, like, a Vegas show. Like, just teach the dogs to dance instead, and you'll make a mint, you know?
Yeah. And it doesn't go well, because again, like we said, Tito gets electrocuted because Oliver slips and hits the ignition. Tito and, enter Jenny. And we find out Jenny's parents are out of the country on a conference, and we talked about a kid learning how to read. She's clearly reading words that she doesn't understand and are too big for her to pronounce. We don't know how old Jenny is. She's just the generic age of child.
Yep.
Yeah. Apparently, the birthday at the end of the movie is supposed to be her 8th birthday.
She's at least in second grade.
Yeah. I mean, we do see her getting off a school bus, It's like a school SUV. But it says school bus on it.
Well, she's clearly in a well-off family, so it's probably a private school of some sort.
All right.
I guess they have their own school SUV then.
I guess. So, yeah, they... Jenny takes Oliver home, and she instantly falls in love with the little orange kitty that she found in her car trying to steal her stereo.
I don't even think she notices the stereo. She's just like, kitty! Yeah.
Well, she clearly knows that the kitty is all tangled up in the wiring.
Well, yeah.
It's like,
But that's kind of me with any animal. Like, everything in the world disappears except for me and that animal. When I spot an animal, it's like, kitty, puppy, you know, whatever. And then, like, there could be a murder going on a block away. There could be, like, a fire, you know. Like, it's not going to matter until I snuggle whatever that is I've just spotted.
I love how she doesn't even feel the need to, like, hide anything from Winston about this cat, because Winston being the butler who is caring for her at this point, because it's kind of, she's very, very sweet. She's, you know, she's not like, what are you going to do about it? She basically just knows that she's going to make this call, and this cat is going to be hers.
Yeah, she's just like, Winston, I have a cat now. Deal with it.
Yeah, I have a cat now. His name is Oliver. And we never actually find out how she comes up with the name Oliver. She just says, this is Oliver now.
You know? Yeah, but if you've ever seen a kid name an animal like that, that is kind of how it happens. And then you have to, like, ask them later, and they'll be like, oh yeah, I picked it because of whatever. But, like, I've seen kids get, like, a new animal. And I know I did that a lot when I was a kid, and they'd be like, what are you going to name it? And I just spit out a name. They'd be like, how did you figure that one out? And I'd be like, I don't know, but that's its name.
That's how I name all my lobsters.
Yeah. Fun, dirty lobster enthusiast.
Cornflake has quite the lobster collection. That's kind of her thing.
The fun fact, my very first cat I ever had was named Mickey McCardo, because I had a problem pronouncing R's when I was little. So I wanted to...
You got some splaining to do.
Yeah, I wanted to name the cat Ricky Ricardo, but I couldn't pronounce Ricky Ricardo, so my cat's name was Mickey McCardo.
My cat had a name that sounded different than what it should have really been, because the person who sold our family the cat had a very thick accent. And evidently, the cat's name was 3C, but when he would say it, it came out Tri-She. So that is how my cat got named, too, by somebody who couldn't say what he was trying to say.
A friend of mine found a dog around town, and it had a collar. And the collar had, like, the collar had the name Chico on it. And he took it home and tried to find the owners and, you know, put out flyers and stuff. Nobody claimed the dog. But he was trying to figure out, he's like, well, it comes from a home. It has a collar, you know. So he was trying to figure out what commands it already knew. So he'd be like, sit, and the dog would just stare at him, and like, come here, and the dog would just stare at him, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden he realized, like, oh no, the dog's name is Chico, and he was like, Chico, a key, and the dog just, like, ran into his arms. He was like, oh, I have a dog that has been completely trained in Spanish up until this point. So he had to learn a little bit of Spanish to communicate with the dog until he could retrain it, which I thought was adorable.
That is totally adorable. That's not the direction I thought the story was going to go in. I thought he was going to go through all the standard commands and then suddenly go, beer me, and the refrigerator door opened.
That would be great.
So, yeah.
Oh, that noise, by the way, we get some thunderstorms running through the outpost right now, so.
All right, hopefully the connection stays solid for the recording here. So
if not, just have a high-pitched giggle every once in a while, and people will still think I'm here.
Right. So let's talk about Georgette, who clearly does not like the new member of the family. And her little
song. By Georgette, do you mean the best character in the movie?
Yeah. Does this technically count as a villain song?
I don't think so.
No, I mean, Georgette's not a villain. She's just annoying.
Bit of a prima donna.
Yeah.
Well, much like Jenny, she sees herself as the only child and is spoiled because she's the prize-winning dog. But although Jenny isn't really spoiled, she just, you know, knows that she can get her what she wants.
Right.
And she goes, and, you know, Georgette has her little song about her beauty routine. And like you said, the little past the censors where she pushes up her bust.
Yeah, her fur that they kind of make look like a bust. I'm going to say that this scene reminded me so much of, I used to be a pet sitter professionally. Mm-hmm. And at one point, you know, I would just get like, a key, an address, and a list of, like, here's the name of the animal, here's the instructions for how to care for the animal, that's it. I would never see a human. You know, just, here's a key, go into this person's house, hope the cops don't show up, which they did at one point. But the, I went into a house where it was like, oh, this, It's a woman who lives alone, and she has a teacup poodle. And, you know, I don't even remember what the dog's name was, but, you know, it's like, Mr. Fluffy or something, you know. And so it had, like, a really cute name, okay? And it was like, oh, he should be really easy. Just go in there and feed him. This teacup poodle was the most vicious dog I've ever come across. It was the only dog I could not actually care for. I had to call my boss and say, like, I can't do this. The dog will not let me within 3 feet of it, and I'm not going to the ER tonight missing a finger and have to tell them it got taken by a teacup poodle. Like, I have my pride. But when you walked into the house, it was like walking into the room where Georgette was. Oh. Everything in this house revolved around that tiny little dog. There were velvet portraits of the dog. There were, like, grand photo shoots of the dog in costume taken by a professional photographer. Everything in there had, like, you know, Mr. Fluffy written on it, you know, embroidered on pillows and written in rhinestones on food bowls and stuff. It's like, this poor woman, I don't know who she was and I never met her, but this poor woman, like, I know now why that dog was so angry. Like, it had bows and its nails were painted and, like, everything, which I'm like, oh, it was such a spoiled, pampered little dog that, like, when somebody came in and tried to treat it like a dog, it went absolutely bonkers. So, yeah, that's exactly what Georgette reminded me of. I'm like, yeah, this is that dog all over again.
And here's that scene I mentioned earlier. You see Georgette laying on her pillow, and there's a whole shelf of pictures of other dogs. And it looks like they just asked every animator in the building, draw a dog, it'll be in the movie.
Yes, and one animator didn't.
Yeah, one animator didn't follow that request, it seems.
Yeah, because one of the dogs is actually a picture of Professor Radigan from The Great Mouse Detective.
George Evans in her experimental phase.
Maybe she's just that famous. Her fame went to London, and you know, here's this evil rat with a top hat that wants to get with Georgette. But then again, The Great Mouse Detective, maybe she just wants to get Georgette and kind of use her for some sort of evil scheme. We don't know. Apparently, he survived falling off Big Ben at the end of that movie.
And then also survived another 100 years.
Yeah.
Because wasn't that like the late 1800s or something?
Yeah. But again, it's much like in Why Should I Worry, you see cameos of other Disney dogs. You see, you know, Pongo, and you see the Peg and her group from Lady and the Tramp. It's just a cameo for the sake of a cameo. It's a blink and you'll miss it.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of them, I actually have the movie Freeze Frame. You see one dog is on balloons. One dog has a captain's hat. Maybe it's Tennille's dog. One dog has a birthday hat on. So it's like, you know, it's like, it's just, everyone in the animation team just draw a dog and it'll be there. A lot of them don't look like they should be in this movie. They're completely different styles. And again, there's the big portrait, like you said, big velvet portrait of Georgette.
Yeah, that was pretty wild. There was something unusual in that music number where the birds, have you ever seen birds care about what a dog is doing? And furthermore, we're supposed to be forming an initial sense of who Georgette is, and she's got like a wreath of birds circling her face and doing synchronized bird dancing. And that is something I feel like we've only seen reserved for Disney princesses. Like, I can imagine birds serenading a Cinderella or a Snow White like that. But the obsession of the birds with Georgette was pretty wild.
Yeah. I guess she's supposed to be the princess. I don't know.
I'm going to honestly say this about the song.
This is the most musical sounding song in the whole movie.
Yeah.
Like, this sounds like just not something you would see as a show tune or hear as a show tune.
There's reason why it was written by Barry Manilow.
Yes.
Which is why it is the best song in the movie.
Yeah.
Because I dare Barry Manilow to write a bad song.
Sorry, Harry Mancini from the last movie. That's what, when you think Disney musical, you'll think Barry Manilow and Harry Mancini, right?
Well, here's the thing, though, is that, you know, they got these other really great singers, and they only bothered to get one composer that actually writes music for the singer in question. Like, if you're not going to have it be a unified soundtrack written by one team, why wouldn't you get... I mean, Barry Manilow got his start writing songs for Bette Midler. Why would you not get Barry Manilow? Why would you not get, you know, somebody that's written for Billy Joel or Billy Joel himself? Somebody that's written for Huey Lewis or Huey Lewis himself? Like, you know, somebody that wrote Pointer Sister songs. Like, why would you not get those people instead, because of all the people that wrote songs for this movie, the only two I actually personally know by name were Howard Ashman and Barry Manilow.
To kind of backtrack, let's backtrack to that to read a song, Streets of Gold. I hate saying it, it is my least favorite song in the movie. It is the most 80s sounding song,
mm-hmm.
but it's like my least favorite. I think, I don't know. I think that's probably why. It's too, I hate saying it, it's too 80s. Even when I was a kid, I didn't really care for the song. Like, it just feels like it's there because they needed a song, I guess.
Yeah, it does feel like filler.
Like, well, we need the girl character to sing a song. We got Ruth Poynter, write a song about how the streets of New York are like gold, Okay, that works.
Done and done.
Done and done. And then to get back where we are in the movie, Jenny with her Cocoa Krispies whipped cream cat food.
Eggs.
And eggs.
Yeah, because she mentions that it's like, oofs to Jenny with Cocoa Krispies or something.
And, you know, Winston actually walks on one of the eggs. I don't even know if this is edible by a human, much less a cat.
That I would probably kill a cat. Yeah.
All the while, and, you know, Georgette does not like her new little brother. Does not like the catalog, because she's just used to being by herself. I think everything from the doorknobs down belongs to her.
Yeah, does
I love
like
that line.
Is...
I love the line, and I love the delivery.
Yes, that is an amazing line, and does not like is putting it lightly.
She straight up does not want another animal on her turf.
Yeah, I like that it's not just cats. Like, it's not a species thing. She's just like, nope, I am the queen around here, and there are no other contenders.
Yeah, she's there not even vying for Jenny's attention. She just wants to be the only dog of, or the only pet of the house.
Yeah. And then, of course, yeah. And, you know, to go back to Dodger and crew, they're forming their plan to find Oliver, go to that house and get him, and meanwhile, we see within hours of this happening, Jenny had gotten a nice new collar for Oliver with his name on it and the address. That's some money. She can get all that done within a day.
And that's where she bought his fancy new bowl, too.
Yeah, with his name on it. While Winston is watching professional wrestling.
When you were a 7-year-old, were you out at the store buying silver engraved bowls for your pets?
No. That's some money right there. That's upstate New York money.
Yeah.
I don't think I knew anybody that could afford a silver engraved bowl, much less for their dog or cat, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's just Jenny's having this day out on the town that even with the relaxed standards of the 80s as compared to today, I couldn't imagine a kid out riding through Central Park in a carriage or making capital purchases for the pets in the house.
Yeah.
That was wild to watch as a kid, you know, seeing a depiction of a small child doing that and then doing what Jenny does later, going off to that that wharf to try to find Oliver.
And she sings her little song, You and Me Tig, which is a cute little song, but it kind of gets grating with that it is just a little kid voice.
Yeah, it's not endearing enough to get away with being what it is.
It's not cute enough. It's there, you can get away with a kid playing a kid and singing like that if the voice is cute enough, but then again, it's we've had that before in Disney movies, like with Jenny herself and Beck and the Rescuers and stuff like that. But it's like, it's a cute little song. It just, Jenny's voice, the voice actor, just it doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't need to go on as long as it does. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But they needed something to be like, well, this kid is, this kid is growing closer to Oliver, and she would be a very good owner for Oliver. Like, she would be loving, and this would be a good household for him. So that you understand why he didn't want to leave. So you have to have the little montage of the two of them growing closer, and I guess the little lullaby-ish kind of song.
It's sort of like Annie, almost. At least that's the impression I got. Like, with Annie and Daddy Warbucks getting closer.
A little bit like that. But we know from later Disney movies that there is such a thing as a charming child number of a song. I mean, compare that to Anna in Do You Want to Build a Snowman?
Yeah.
Which isn't grating at all. So it was possible to turn that song into something that wasn't.
They probably could have had another child singer do the role, do the song, much like they did having Ruth Poynter doing Rita's singing voice.
Yeah.
Well, honestly, I think was she not a child when that happens? I don't actually know what age the actress is, but I think she's the appropriate age. I couldn't really find much about her.
Yeah, she's like a few years older than I am. And so if I was around 9, she would have been in her early teenage years.
Yeah, like 12 or something. I mean, that can still sound cute. Especially for girls. Because mm-hmm. girls can still do, you know, there's not really the sort of voice breaking deepening thing. Most women don't go through that, but it was all right. But I think if you're going to have that little kid voice, I think if the little kid that played young Anna in Frozen had been singing a less cute song, that would have annoyed me more. I think I let the little kid voice go because that's a really good song.
Yes. So we would agree then that the song was, while necessary, maybe lacking and could have been written better.
Yeah. And so let's fast forward with the crew getting into Jenny's house, Tito flirting with Georgette because... Yeah. Gotta have that Latin lover stereotype because Latino, I guess. And like Georgette is just not having it at all. Even though, you know, Tito thinks that she's all crazy for him. But once they say that they're there for the cat, she's already just getting rid of Oliver and completely.
Fully on board.
Yes, get this cat out of my house.
To the point where she hides the other dogs rather convincingly under her nightgown.
Yeah. Except for Tito, who's hanging on the wall because she does not want him anywhere near her. But yeah, she just grabs Oliver and throws him, and they put him in a pillowcase and just drag him out. It's like, that's how little she cares about Oliver. Just throw him. Not even aiming. Just throw him. And poor Oliver is like, he has no idea what's going on. He's happy there. He's happy with Jenny. He wants to be with her. And it's like, this really ticks off Dodger, because they went through all that hassle to get him. And in her eyes, it's like, Dodger's eyes, like, we're not good enough for you. Now, you know, you live.
Where's your loyalty, feline?
You know, that's what really gets me. It's like, they treat Oliver like he's been with them forever, and he's only been with them like a day. He's family. He's blood. You've known him 24 hours. Mm-hmm. But who knows? I mean,
dogs and loyalty and all.
I guess dogs and loyalty. I guess, you know. But yeah, Dodger really did takes a person. Like, you want to go back to your owner? Go back, because you know you don't need us anymore. You live on the upside of town. You live in the rich house with the rich girl.
Jealous much?
Yeah, and kudos to Fagin. Fagin now has his way out of Sykes by ransoming off poor Oliver, because he thinks that Oliver's new owner is a very rich cat owner person. I love that phrase in the that's the phrase he comes up with. Dear Mr. Very Rich Cat Owner Person.
Yes.
And then, of course, the reveal later when it's a kid, like the owner of Oliver is a kid with a piggy bank.
Oh, and the expression on Georgette's face when she has to go with Jenny to get the cat back.
Yeah, I'm surprised that we don't see one scene of her saying, well, Georgette, you're a dog, sniff him out. I don't think
Georgette's not expected to do anything.
No.
The interesting thing is, though, is that I don't understand why all of a sudden they have the little kid show up with, like, a piggy bank. like she's a poor child.
Yeah, she just bought a silver engraved bowl.
5 minutes earlier, she's at the silver engraved nonsense store buying cat bowls, not blinking an eye. She could have just been like, Winston, write me a check for $5,000. I must go buy more cat food. It would just be like, okay.
Yeah. And the way that Georgette just throws Oliver's bowl in the trash like it's nothing.
Yeah.
She could have brought, like, one of Georgette's collars, and it would have been worth enough to, like, get Fagin out of trouble, probably.
Or one of Georgette's outfits.
Like, any random nonsense from that house would have probably been enough at a pawn shop to, like, you know, pay off whatever Fagin owes.
But kid logic.
This kid comes with a piggy bank.
And you can probably see her parents, like, the child wants a piggy bank. Why? We give her everything. I don't know. It's a child thing. She wants one. Put some change in it so it rattles. Like, there's no use. She's not saving up for anything. It's just another, like, objet d'art in the house. Like,
other kids have piggy banks on the TV shows they watch. I want one, too.
Yes.
Yes, her little piggy bank with loose change that, you know, she just... Again, she could have easily taken out her daddy's credit card like she did at the other stores and just, here, just buy whatever you need. It's done. And we get a little bit more into Sykes's personality. Apparently, Sykes is an avid model builder because he's building model ships. He has a complete model of his car.
Oh, yeah.
That... once again, Fagin breaks the rearview mirror off of.
Yeah.
On the same side he broke it off of earlier in the movie. Now it matches.
I think the coolest thing about Sykes is that he has a vanity license plate that reads Dobe R Man.
Yes. He really loves his dogs.
He has this moment where he's observing Fagin and he's realizing that he's set this kid up to provide money for the cat. And he thinks just for a split second that Fagin is more intelligent than he originally gave him credit for. And then he watches Fagin just give the cat back to the kid. And it's all over for Fagin at that point. But
yeah, the fact that Fagin's downfall was that he had a heart.
Yeah. Sykes is totally jazzed, though, for a minute there that Fagin is going to pull the money from this poor little kid.
Swindling a kid. I mean, it's like, he even, when Fagin tells him the plan, hey, I have this cat from this rich owner, and I'm going to get the money tonight. Oh, kidnapping! Even if it's just a cat, you're moving up in the world.
Yes, from congratulations!
From being like a pickpocket to... kidnapping! I'm impressed!
And then, of course, if Fagin's not going to do this right, I have to do it by myself, and there goes Jenny.
Yeah. Oh.
That was as a little kid, that was a twist I did not see coming.
Consider your debt paid.
Yeah.
It makes a lot more sense than apparently the original three or four ways this was supposed to play out.
Yeah.
Because apparently the ending of the movie, or how Fagin was going to try to pay off the debt, was changed several times, including there was going to be a subplot where Oliver was going to be useful for ransom because it turns out he was a rare breed of Asian cat that, like, his original owner just didn't know or something. And then they changed that, and it was going to be like Sykes sent Fagin out to steal a panda from the zoo so he could ransom the panda. Which is like, what? So we almost had a panda subplot in this movie for no reason.
See, at that point, you bring in Bernard and Bianca and make it the sequel to The Rescuers.
Yeah.
That's what this movie is missing, a panda.
So yeah, and again, Sykes kidnaps Jenny, and I do love that you get little Oliver in a football helmet as a cannonball just to go into through the window, because he's going to be the one to rescue Jenny.
My favorite part of that was that they have Francis up there, and he's preparing for his role, and they're like, Francis, just do it, and then he jumps off, and it turns out he's just the person catapulting Oliver through the window. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, all he has to do is jump, but he's up there, like, reciting monologues, preparing for his role.
And this is kind of the part where Georgette starts warming up to Tito, because Tito's actually treating her like a lady.
Trying to save Jenny, which I think that even though Georgette doesn't make it seem like that, that she actually cares enough about Jenny to be like, well, I don't want her to be kidnapped.
Yeah. The fact that she went with him and not have gone home, you know, as...
Yeah, she could have turned tail.
Instead, she broke a nail and cried about it and gave away their position. Which has poor Tito getting electrocuted again by trying to cut the mics off, trying to cut the cameras off.
Yeah. And then again while trying to get the, like, hook, forklifty thing, whatever that is, crane. And
again, he only does it because Georgette kind of starts falling back with him. He's like, please do it, Alonzo. Like, okay, and then you get your little... Your little Snow White reference with him singing "Hi Ho."
Yes.
Oh no, I forgot about that. Tito actually sings "I Could Dance All Night."
Yeah, it's like, I don't know why, if you're gonna bring in a Broadway musical, you bring in My Fair Lady instead of the musical that was based off the same book.
Yeah. Maybe that was the song they can get the rights to.
Yeah, but he doesn't use enough of it for it to actually run afoul of...
And he doesn't sing it in the right tempo. He just randomly says, I could dance all night.
Yeah, which is...
It's possible they could have seen My Fair Lady on their little broken TV at one point. Who knows? But yeah, if it had been a song from the Oliver musical, it would have been a nice little meta joke that only the grown-ups in the audience would have gotten.
Yeah.
I do like the trick they do by pretending to be a pizza man.
That is so great. It reminded me of, what did they call it in the Muppet movie when they do that, Muppets Most Wanted?
I haven't seen that movie in a while, so I don't even know.
Where they all stand on each other, but, or Muppet Ladder, I think is what they
Muppet
call
Ladder.
It. Yeah, it was kind of Muppet Ladder-ish to watch them make assemble to form a pizza man.
Even Tito kind of having the shaggy hair with the cap on. Where did they get the cap from? I don't know.
The one-eyed like pizza man.
Dog Voltron. Yeah.
Dog Voltron. As, they're all trying to rescue Jenny, and they do the thing with the... again, Tito... getting electrocuted for the third time in this movie for the sole purpose of trying to impress Georgette. And poor Francis letting his little his obsession of certain television shows get the best of him as he changes the monitor to watch a ballet performance.
Oh yeah, he's supposed to be watching for Sykes and where Sykes is in the building, and he's watching his TV instead.
Yeah. And it's a nice little chase scene. Short chase scene, but, you know, the little chase scene of them going down that conveyor belt, whatever it is. And it looks like they're about to get caught, and then here comes Fagin and their little motorbike that's tied to a shopping cart.
Yes. The shopping scooter.
Shopping scooter. That sounds like he probably took it from Walmart at some point. Took a shopping cart, took the mobility scooter, and hopped it up.
As they're coming down that chute.
Yeah. And they have that great chasing of Sykes in the limo and them on the scooter that ends up on in the subway in the New York. I'm surprised he's able to get the car down that, because I've gone down subways. They're not that wide.
Nope.
Cartoon logic, I guess. Or it's a very small limo. And yeah, they ended up on the train. And one of the longest running gags in this movie is Tito wants to drive.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he wants to drive the limo. He wants to... And he finally gets his chance to drive the scooter while Fagin is trying to reach for Jenny's hand. How did Jenny learn Fagin's name? Because she says, Mr. Fagin, help me. Like, never once did Fagin ever tell her his name.
Hmm.
Unless Sykes said something.
Huh, good point.
I think he does when he comes up. I think he says something about Mr. Fagin.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that Tito driving ends up probably being the thing that saves him. Because he's the one that ends up veering off the track. Isn't he?
Yeah.
And up the side of the suspension
and,
bridge.
Yeah.
Yep, side of the bridge. Would they technically be in Jersey at that point?
I honestly don't know. I don't know enough about the geography of New York. Let's talk about the poor dogs, though, because I felt bad for what happened to the poor Dobermans worse than I did what happens to Sykes.
So, yes, they're on the subway train tracks, and those are electrocuted because subway is run on electricity. Yeah, the fact that he, I do have to say Sykes, pulling the shift down, breaking it off, and grinding his tires to the point where it's just the rims on the rails. Again, cars are not that wide, but okay.
But it is an old animation joke for some reason.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, the rubber comes off the tires and the rims become, like, train wheels.
Yeah.
Is a remarkably old animation trope, and I don't really know why. Because, like you said, cars aren't that wide.
So it's either small enough to fit down a subway entrance or wide enough to fit on subway tracks.
Yeah.
Cartoon logic.
Yes.
So, yeah, as... Yeah, we get the Dobermans fighting off Oliver and Dodger. And Dodger, Dodger murders two Dobermans?
No. That's not how it happens. Because I rewound the scene to look at it because I was like, wait a minute. One of them grabs Dodger's, like...
Scarf.
And it comes off and he falls.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was accidental. However, then the other Doberman shows up and Oliver repeats what he did at the beginning of the movie and scratches the Doberman's nose, causing the Doberman to fall. Oliver straight up murders the Doberman.
Yes.
Dodger is kind of blameless.
Yeah, but here's the thing is that you see one of them hit the tracks and get electrocuted.
Yep. Yeah, it's not pleasant.
This is...
Yay, kid movie.
This is different from even a year later, 2 years later, with the way Gaston would die in Beauty and the Beast. Like, you don't even see him die. You see him fall into the abyss and just that's it. The only closest thing I would think of would be Clayton, where you actually see the shadow of Clayton and Tarzan hanging by his neck on the vine.
Yeah.
Like you, but you straight up see... The Doberman hit the track and that electric spark. You only see it once. They don't show it a second time. When the other Doberman falls off, you assume that's what happened, but they don't show it. I guess they can only show it once to make this a G-rated movie. Yes, this is a G-rated kids movie.
I remember
in which a
sitting
guy
there
gets
in shock
pancaked.
And watching that.
Yeah, a G-rated kids movie in which a guy gets pancaked by a train.
Yep.
Yep. I guess you don't see blood and guts. You just see a train.
Well, no, you do see that car crunch.
Yeah.
Like, that is a really bad... You don't actually see Sykes inside of it, but you do see that car crunch and then get shoved off and explode on the way down into the water.
That was, at the time, traumatic enough for me that I didn't even process the actual end of the movie. I remembered everything up to that point when I watched it again the other night. And I think after that, my little brain, when I was 9, just kind of tuned out.
Don't play on the train tracks, kids. You might That's get run over and killed. That's what that movie was trying to tell you. So yeah, they make it home. They save Jenny. They, you know, I have to give them the benefit for the little fake out to make them look like Oliver had died for like a second. Mm. But you know, we can't have our main character die. This is a Disney movie.
Well, all dogs go to heaven.
Oh, yeah.
But he's a cat. I don't know about cats. You don't know. Hell, All Dogs Go to Heaven 2 had the cats in hell.
Yeah. All Dogs Go to Heaven, all cats are bastards and go straight to hell.
Yeah. So, and then we see
But this ends with one of my dreams. Jenny has my dream birthday party. It's all just dogs. A bunch of dogs, and the dogs bring me presents. Yeah.
It's junk presents, but it's presents.
Well, they're dogs. You can't expect too much. It is the thought that counts.
And they are legitimately singing the actual Happy Birthday song, which was a rarity in movies prior to 2000.
Yeah.
Because at that point, that song was still under copyright. So they actually Disney straight up paid for the use of the song Happy Birthday.
So that a couple of dogs can go, wah, 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 wah.
I love that.
Speaking of dogs barking, one of my favorite joke in the whole movie is when Fagin's reading the storybook and he goes like, ruff, 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 the dog said. And the dogs all kind of look at him and he's like, oh, really? You do it. And the dog barks and he's like, well, yeah, because you're a dog.
Yes.
And that is the most Dom DeLuise line there is.
Yeah.
It's almost
such a good reading.
Not just a Dom DeLuise line. That was definitely like something you would hear Edwin say, voicing the Mad Hatter. And of course you see Tito teaching Georgette how to dance the Spanish style.
Yeah.
With the Spanish music. While Fagin and Winston are watching pro wrestling. Why not? Because why not?
Yeah, and it's a great idea to bet the poor guy who clearly doesn't have any money, you know, and have a wager on the match.
On the fake fight.
Right. Yeah, but you notice that Winston doesn't actually, like, push it or seem mad when he's like, oh, yeah, I'm gotta go. I'll get you later.
Such a scoundrel.
Yeah.
Now, you think he's talking about Dodger, but I would assume he was talking about Fagin.
Mm-hmm. I love the fact that Fagin wears like 4 watches and one of them is the Mickey Mouse watch.
Yeah.
Because you gotta get your branding.
That was everywhere in the 80s.
You gotta get your branding.
That was also just to me the 80s touch.
Yes.
Like that Mickey Mouse watch was the 80s.
I had one.
Wanted one, but never got it.
They still make them. They're like really expensive now.
They were really expensive then for like me and my family. So nope.
I like how we have kind of the gag at the beginning. It comes back with the broken tennis racket.
Yeah.
Because at the beginning, Einstein grabs a broken tennis racket as one of the treasures to give to Sykes, then he ends up giving it to Jenny.
Yeah, that's pretty cute.
Well, it is his prized possession.
Yes.
Like I said, it's a thought that counts.
And of course, Jenny is wearing a red dress that makes her look like Annie.
Annie, yes.
Continue the Annie connection in this movie. And
but we gotta say the last little bit of what happens to Tito, because I do kind of like that.
Oh yeah.
He gets what he wants. You know, Georgette is all into him, and you know, hey, but if you're gonna be my man, You gotta at least take a bath.
You need a makeover.
You know, it's I hate saying it. It is a trope of, you know, the rich girl falls for the poor guy, and now she wants to change him to be more like the kind of guy she would go with anyway. Her class.
Well,
yeah.
Well, yes, but Tuesday, I'm going to ask you, are you saying that Georgette is perhaps an uptown girl?
I see what you did there. So why not have her hook up with Dodger?
Yeah. I think Dodger has better taste than Georgette, honestly.
Yeah, poor Tito. He had to take a bath and put on a costume.
Georgette is a great character and my favorite character in the movie. But like, if you knew somebody with that personality, I would not want to date somebody with that personality. That would be a nightmare relationship.
And Tito got out of there. He's like, nope. He got more than he bargained for. He finally got, you know, the uptown girl, as you say, but you know, she wants to turn him into an uptown guy, and he's saying, no, thank you.
And an uptown guy in Georgette's mind wears a sailor's outfit and a pink bow on its tail.
Well, she is a show dog, so she wants him to look like a show dog.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we do weird things to show dogs, and perhaps maybe let's not do those things anymore.
Right, because the dogs clearly don't enjoy it.
Yeah,
I do like how she goes the trope of calling the person in trouble by their full name.
Yes.
you know, every kid knows that once your parents call you by your full name, you are in trouble.
I actually had a kid correct me on that once.
What?
Yeah, it was like, I'm just going to make up a name, but I was like, you know, Susan Smith, stop doing what you're doing. And she turned around, it's like 5 years old, and she turns around and she's like, no, it's Susan Rebecca Smith.
Oh,
stop doing what you're doing. Like, she actually like gave me pointers on how to discipline her.
That girl is a pro at getting in trouble.
You have to say the middle name or it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, it's not legit.
Yeah, and then of course we as the Sykes and the crew are leaving, we get one last round of why should I worry or why should we worry, which it's really cool seeing you know, Billy Joel and Ruth Pointer singing the song. And I would have liked if it was just those two singing that song. But, you know, then you get Roscoe Lee Brown completely out of tune and completely out of tempo, which I get is part of the joke, but I would have liked if it was a straight singing the song, you know, all of them singing the song together.
They could have let us enjoy that.
Yeah.
And Cheech Marin, too.
I mean, Cheech Marin's in tune.
Yeah.
as close to tune as Cheech Marin can be and still sound like Cheech Marin.
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure it's Cheech Marin actually sang and not in a character. Now he's done some songs. We're familiar with the Dr. Memento show and his Cheech the School Bus Driver song. We know that.
Yeah.
But if he actually sang in an actual singing voice, he wouldn't sound like Cheech Marin.
Yeah.
So I get that. But you know, if he had sang in that and all of them singing like legit, it probably would have been a better ending. Hell, you even get Don DeLuise singing in on it. Because he can sing. Dude can sing. We've heard him singing in All Dogs Go to Heaven. And in American Tale. He still sounds like Dom DeLuise, but you know, I think it would have been a better hop. It would have been, you know, like, it wouldn't have made sense that he would know that song, but why not? Let's just have some fun. And that's the end of Oliver and Company, as we started with Huey Lewis singing, and now we ended with Billy Joel singing.
All the crazy.
We could have used a little bit more Ruth Pointer singing. I don't know how our acting skills would have been. Who knows?
Yeah, I actually kind of in some of my research, I was looking up, and nobody seems to know why the singing voice was changed, like why it's a different speaking and singing voice for Rita. So. Because, like I said, the main actress can sing, so, and well, So
maybe they just wanted a known 80s pop star.
That's what I suspect.
It's the 80s. They tried to get some... I mean, we're a few years away from Robin Williams as the genie in terms of stunt casting. But, you know, they tried to do what they got. You know, tried to do something to get people to see their movie. And it did kind of work. This made money. Not enough to beat Land Before Time. But it clearly... You can see the beginnings of what would become the Disney Renaissance in here. It's not quite there yet.
Right.
Again, it's a prototype. It's like, you can kind of... Between this and Great Mouse Detective, you can kind of see the direction that they're going. They're still kind of stuck in that era of the way they were doing movies in the 70s. But they're starting to get to where they were doing with Little Mermaid. If you had seen all these movies in order, you would wonder where the hiccup went wrong with the Black Cauldron. But you can kind of see where they're going.
Yeah. And if nothing else, when you go back and watch this movie, for all its flaws, you do have a delightful period piece for the late 80s. Because this movie, for everything that's wrong with it, is just chock full of 80s goodness when you want to take a little bit of a stroll down memory lane.
Yeah, if you were a kid in the 80s, this is memory lane for you. We even get a date, because there's a calendar in Sykes's, in Fagin's house, little hut, April 21st, 1988.
Wow.
So this is in springtime, probably around the time Roger Rabbit was coming out.
Yep.
I assume. So it's like, this definitely takes place in the year it came out. About 6 to 8 months prior to be coming out. But yeah, Oliver and Company. Do you want to ask the question?
Might as well.
Does this movie have the magic? Kiki, what's your opinion?
Oh, you're going to start with me?
Yes.
Oh. No.
Oh.
I'm sorry. This was a slog for me to get through. I would have turned it off if I didn't have to watch it for the podcast.
this is a pretty short for a Disney movie.
At least it was short.
An hour and 15 minutes.
What's the Mystery Science Theater joke? Like, well, it was bad, but at least it was short. I will tell you, like I said, my father watched part of the movie with me during a break from work, and we got to the end of the first song, just the introduction song with the credits, okay? And my father said, well, I think Black Cauldron is easily the worst movie that Disney ever made. This might be second.
No!
So, that was his assessment after literally like 3 minutes of the movie. I don't know. I thought, you could have done so much better, in my opinion, with the idea of Oliver Twist, but with dogs. Instead, they're like, well, let's keep some of the names, remove any of the morals of the story, and make one of the more villainous villains in literary history into, like, you know, a nice little schlubby guy who, you know, lives in a hovel. I prefer that to the normal Fagin portrayals, which are extremely anti-Semitic and weird. But I don't know. It's like, as much as I'm not a huge Dickens fan, because we've talked about that before, he did at least try to put morals in the story, and like, there is no moral to this story. And usually Disney films have them. You know, the power of love, or the, you know, good friendship or family, or none of those are really in this. It's just like, here's some stuff that happened to an animal. weren't you entertained for 70 minutes, children? All right, give us money.
I'm going to disagree, but I think a lot of it is that myself and Cornflake grew up with this movie, so it's a bit of a nostalgia. So I want to say maybe with a slight yes, because, like, I watched this movie, and there are some parts that do slog for me. Again, Rita's song about Streets of Gold. Ruth Pointer is a great singer, not a good song. And Jenny's song to Oliver, again, cute song, just didn't really work. But to me, it's like, it's this song, this has a little bit of the nostalgia bug for me. So I'm going to say this has a little bit of magic. Cornflake.
Full disclosure, though it wasn't the main topic of today's show, Roger Rabbit, Framed Roger Rabbit, really freaked me out. And I did see that in the theaters the same year that I saw Oliver and Company. So when I saw Oliver and Company, I felt like for Disney, things were back on the up and up, or at least going in the right direction. I've heard enough of an argument in just discussing this movie with you that maybe it's tough to say that this movie has the Disney magic. It certainly has 80s magic, no doubt about that. And I appreciate you letting me come on to the show and talk about it from that standpoint. But when you compare it to so many other things that we love with Disney, it pales in comparison. However, I still found when I watched it again that the heartwarming things that I remembered about it from a kid were still heartwarming now. Is it fair to say that it has Disney magic because I'm a total sucker for Billy Joel? I don't know.
There is something salvageable in this movie. That's what I'm trying to say. There's something salvageable, whether it's, you know, hey, there's Billy Joel, here's Ruth Pointer, here's Cheech Marin, here's pre-heartthrob Jory Lawrence, here's Dom DeLuise. I don't know.
I appreciate that Disney, through this movie, was trying to dazzle us with stars, and I appreciate that with... The next big movie to come along was The Little Mermaid, right? There were no big stars in that. They did something different, and that thing took off. But for its time, I would say, being prior... Like, if they had made this movie after The Little Mermaid, we would have been like, what the heck? But they didn't.
That's what we had Rutgers Down Under for.
Right. Yeah.
Like, what the hell? You had Little Mermaid. What happened?
Yeah. Keep in mind
that this is the movie that they were pitching in that big meeting that they pitched the same, that they also pitched Oliver and Company to.
So, enough Disney magic for me to... I like the movie, to like it still.
Yeah, I don't...
Well, I do think that if I'd have seen this as a kid, I would have a more warm feeling toward it.
Yeah.
Because we've talked about a few of those on here where it's like, we realize as adults they're not really that great, but you do kind of get the warm fuzzies. So if you saw this when you were a kid, or you remember the 80s, maybe you might find some warm fuzzies here, but I don't really know how appealing this would be to a kid today.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a question I could have answered for you guys if I wanted to expose my kiddo a dog electrocuted on a train track.
But I think you made a valid choice. I'm not sure I would choose, you know? I mean...
It depends on the age of the kid and how sensitive... Because we've known some kids that even in their double digits are very sensitive kids who probably would not even... handle this kind of a movie with especially the last 15 minutes of this movie.
I know some adults that wouldn't be able to handle the last 15 minutes of this movie. That's no knock on.
Well, just, we have friends who straight up will not watch a movie in which harm comes to a dog. Mm. Even if it's a villain dog.
Which I find a valid choice, honestly, yes. But...
Just, poor Roscoe, poor DeSoto, just, ooh. They didn't deserve that kind of ending.
They weren't bad. They were just drawn that way.
They were trained that way.
Yeah. I really did love Bette Midler's song. Mm-hmm. That was like, that bit has magic. Like, I'd listen to that and watch that sequence over and over again, and I probably will.
Like I said, Georgette, Perfect Isn't Easy is just the most, it's the most Disney sounding song in this movie, and it's the most musical, something that would actually feel like it's in a musical. And yes, like you said, a lot of it had to do with, you know, the writing, who wrote it and who sang it.
And I checked after I watched this movie. I'm like, oh, I wonder if they did lift one song from Oliver the Musical and that was it. And no, it was written for the movie. But they had me fooled.
Yeah. All right. So that's our, I guess that'll be our thoughts on Oliver and Company. There's something here, but it's clearly not one of Disney's best.
I think
you can. But you can see where they're going. You can see where they're going. Especially with, if you say that the next movie after this is Little Mermaid.
I still appreciate that I got to sit here and talk with you two about it today.
And we love the fact that you decided to come onto the podcast with us.
It was a real honor. Thank you for having me here on your show. Right.
So we do have some final business, and that is, as a first-time guest, you are allowed a request. So, Cornflake, what film would you like us to talk about next time?
Oh, next time. Well, let's keep the ball rolling with puppies. How about 101 Dalmatians?
That is doable. I am all for that. Kiki, are you for that?
Oh, any chance to get my Cruella de Vil on?
Yes.
So we're heading to a Dalmatian plantation next week. That phrase hasn't aged well at all.
Nope.
And neither have parts of that movie, and we will get into that next week, I'm sure.
So, Cornflake, is there anything that you want to plug while we still have you here?
Well, if you want to hear me talk about the 80s some more, that's something we do a lot on the Flopcast, which is my podcast along with my co-host Kevin Eldridge. We have a show out every week at flopcast.net, and you can find us on your favorite podcast catcher as well.
All right, so tune in next week as we will be talking about 101 Dalmatians, keeping the theme of dogs. So if you want to contact us, there are the usual ways: Facebook and Twitter. And, of course, you can get our podcasts on iTunes and Spotify. Check them out. Give us a review. It would really help our ratings because we're a very small podcast and we need all the attention we can get.
Pay attention to us!
I learned so many cool things from this podcast about stuff that goes on behind the scenes at Disney. I can't thank you two enough for that.
Well, you're welcome. It's always fun to talk about this. It's getting our Disney nerd on.
Yeah.
It's so magnificent.
Thank you. That means a lot to us. So for all of you, thank you for listening, and we will talk to every one of you again next week. Bye.
Bye. Peace and cookies.
Thank you for listening to Rewatching the Magic. We invite you to keep the magic going by joining the conversation online. Find us on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic, on Twitter at RewatchTheMagic, and of course, find all new episodes at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Until next time, remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.